This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, it's me, Gary Clinton, and this is Night Transmissions, episode 113 to be exact. Gonna start off today with an episode of Secrets of Scotland Yard, which was a production of the Towers of London Company between 1949 and 1951, which would also be brought to the United States by the Mutual Broadcasting System in the mid-50s. Its best-known competitor was the Black Museum, with that show being better known and better remembered, largely because it had as its narrator the inimitable Mr. Orson Welles. The two shows were really very similar, in fact, so similar that sometime the same cases were dramatized by both series. Fully different scripts and cast, of course. You know, at the same time those other two shows were running, there was a third show running in the United States on NBC. I'm not going to go into a lot of details about that show. It was called Whitehall 1212 and was produced, as I said, in the United States by NBC, but it did have a totally British cast to make it sound authentic. Perhaps slightly less authentic, but also extremely excellent, was the fact that Willis Cooper, who is well known in old-time radio circles for his contributions to the golden age of radio, including producing and creating such shows as Quiet Please and Lights Out. I'll have more about Whitehall 1212 next week, when I, for the first time, present an episode of that series. Today's show begins with a Mr. Dickers, who doesn't really play a significant role in the program as a whole, but he's talking to the managers of a hotel that he's staying at, the Hotel Metropole. He's there to establish that this is a very nice place, very comfortable place, a very relaxed place, a place where the owners are very picky about their clientele, and they don't let just anyone in. So you wouldn't expect a murder in a place like this. Accidents happen, of course, sometimes very unpleasant ones. People do die, even nice old ladies. So from about 1950, we have Smoke Clings to the Hair.
How do you do? You've heard me speak of Percy Hoskins, the crime reporter. Well, this time I brought him along, and if he wasn't standing here listening, I'd tell you that he's probably the greatest crime reporter we've ever had in this country. Not that you'd guess it by his appearance. A big, genial fellow, doesn't even be at all depressed by his life with crime. Percy, if I hadn't known you, I might have taken you for, a lawyer. No, you look too happy for a lawyer. Not quite. I know. An actor. A character actor.
You would, Clive?
Yes, I think so. That's right. A character actor. Now, if you hadn't known me, what would you say I was?
A crime reporter.
You would? Thanks very much. Seriously, though, Percy, is there anything in physiognomy? Does Scotland Yard take any account of, let us say, criminal types?
They used to. Hence the collection of death masks of murderers in the Black Museum. Scotland Yard had these made in the hope of discovering some common feature or similarity, but it didn't work out.
No, I don't quite agree with that. When I see a picture of a murderer, he always looks like a criminal to me.
Of course he does. That's because you know he's a murderer.
No, I don't. Not always. But what you say is a great relief. You know, I often find myself looking at my friends and wondering.
Well, don't look at me.
Sorry. Then, if you're right, and type and appearance aren't guides, Scotland Yard must base its search on the belief that no crime is perfectly committed. Some clue is always there to be found.
Not quite. I've no doubt the perfect murder can and has been committed. But the only time the criminal can safely relax is after the doctor has certified death from natural causes. The body has been cremated, and all possibility of suspicion removed. Unfortunately, most murderers fail to reach such a state of self-assurance without making some tiny slip.
And with crime detection developed to the pitch it is, one tiny slip is enough for Scotland Yard to develop a chain of evidence from which a criminal simply cannot escape.
I've often heard them say, if it hadn't been for that, I'd have got away with it.
Now, such a tiny slip occurred in the case we're going to tell you about. Smoke clings to the hair, we call it. A simple fact to remember. But the tiny slip that brought a criminal to justice. Our scene is the lobby of one of the better-known commercial hotels in the seaside town of Margate, England. The time is a little after 11 o'clock at night. The wife of the hotel manager, Mrs. Harding, is chatting with one of her guests, a commercial traveler named Dickens.
I'm glad we were able to make you comfortable.
Oh, I always look forward to my stay at the Metropole. Not like some hotels I could tell you about.
Well, we always do try and take a personal interest in our guests. It's just so much pleasanter all round, I think.
You're quite right there, Mrs. Harding. As I was saying to your husband only yesterday, what we need in the world today is more genuine friendliness. If there was more of that, we wouldn't have half the troubles we do.
Well, it costs nothing, does it? A pleasant word and a smile.
Oh, good evening, Mr. Dickens. Good evening to you, Mr. Harding.
Do you know what Mr. Dickens has just been saying, dear? That he always looks forward to his stay at the Metropole.
Well, that's very nice of you, I'm sure. Friendly place. That's what I like about it. And a nice class of people who stay here.
Well, we do try and be careful. We've got a good name and we can afford to pick and choose a bit.
Well, that reminds me. How's the old lady who had the fainting fit?
Mrs. Fox, do you mean? Oh, she's much better. I went up to see her this afternoon. The doctor says it wasn't anything serious.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. Poor dear. Well, she's lucky in one thing. That son of hers. I don't know when I've ever seen a young man so devoted.
You may well say that. Never lets her out of his sight if he can help it. I really don't know what she'd do without him. She can hardly walk herself, you know.
Talking about Mr. Fox, a funny thing happened.
Yes?
I happened to meet him about half an hour ago, just as he was coming out of the bar. You know how he is ordinarily. Always ready with a smile and a word or two.
Yes, very friendly young fellow.
Well, would you believe it? He stared at me. Or rather, through me, more like, just as if he'd seen a ghost. Then he ran down the passage into the lobby and up the stairs.
Oh, that's funny. Not like him at all, that.
You met him outside the bar, you say? Had he been drinking?
That's the first thing that came into my mind. Fact is, I hopped into the bar and asked Ellie. She said all she'd served him with was a glass of beer.
Well, that says a lot for the strength of your beer.
Funny thing sometimes. I don't suppose there's anything in it.
What's that?
Was shouting.
Oh, did you hear what he was shouting for?
Sounds like upstairs.
Hurry, do something.
So, carry on. I'm coming.
I'm not Mr. Fox.
Wait, ladies, who's on the stairs?
Which room is it?
What's my mother's room?
66, and I can't get in there.
What, the door locked?
No, the room's full of smoke, and I couldn't get in. My mother's in there. She'll be suffocated.
Ooh, I can smell smoke.
This is it. In there. Mother. Mother! Oh, do try and get her out!
Here, get out of the way and let me get that door open.
Look out! Look out!
Oh, good heavens! Look at
him! We've got to get in there! The old lady!
You can't get through it!
Take it easy, my lamb. We'll have a damn good try.
Better let me, Mr. Dickens.
No, I've had some experience of this sort of thing during the war. Oh,
help tie this handkerchief over my
right arm.
No.
There you are, that's got it.
Now look, I'm going to crawl along the floor.
Yes, but
the smoke isn't so dense there.
Yes,
if I'm not out in 2 or 3 minutes, come and get me.
Oh, you'll never make it.
But Dickens did make it. Choking, blinded, tortured by the dense clouds of thick, acrid smoke, he battled his way across the room until he came to the bed. Sprawled across it, he found Mrs. Fox, and somehow, summoning up reserves of strength that he didn't know he possessed, he managed to drag the heavy body back out of the room into the corridor before finally collapsing. By this time, other guests in the hotel had been aroused, and volunteers from amongst them fought their way through the billowing smoke and put out the flames. A doctor was sent for, and every available means used to revive Mrs. Fox, but no spark of life appeared. Word was brought to Sidney Fox that his mother was dead.
Mother, she's gone. There, Mr. Fox. You must try and bear up.
Poor young fella. He was so devoted to her.
I left her, reading her papers by the fire. I should never have done it. I only went out for a moment before going to bed.
She must have left the gas fire on when she went to bed. Something caught fire.
The gas fire was on when I went into the room. I noticed it.
Oh, why did I leave her? Why did I leave her?
Oh, you poor boy. Oh, you poor, poor boy. I don't know what to say to comfort you. It was a cruel thing to happen. This wasn't your fault. Just a terrible accident.
I came back. I went in to say goodnight. It was all smoke.
Here comes the doctor.
Well, doctor, you better do something for Mr. Fox. He's taking it very hard.
The smoke was so thick I couldn't get any other help. My poor mother. I couldn't even get into the room. I couldn't get past the door.
Couldn't get into the book. If he had, he would probably have been overcome. You remember Dickens was a big, powerful man, and he only managed it because he had sufficient experience to tie a handkerchief over his face and keep close down on the floor where the smoke was less thick. If you feel that Fox is to blame for not even trying, all I can assure you is that no one who was present on that tragic occasion felt that he was in any way to blame for acting as he did. Even the coroner, in returning a verdict of accidental death, felt impelled to express his great sympathy as the bereaved son. His sentiments were shared by everybody in the hotel who had observed the devoted care Fox lavished on his crippled mother. But, as you can readily understand, there would be a vast difference between personally witnessing an event of this kind and reading a report that gave nothing more than the cold facts. Mr. William Charles Crocker had only cold facts to deal with. He was the solicitor to the insurance company with which Fox had insured his mother's life. A brief account of the circumstances of Mrs. Fox's death came to him, accompanied by an insurance claim for £3,000 payable to the devoted son, Sidney Harry Fox. Mr. Crocker felt he had a good and sufficient reason to call in the firm's private investigator, an ex-Scotland Yard man, and discuss the matter with him.
I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
What in particular strikes you as fishy about this business, Mr. Crocker?
A good many things. But the chief one is this. See this entry? Fox came here on Monday, the 21st of October, to extend the policies on his mother's death by accident by 2 days. Just 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
Until midnight, the 23rd of October. She's discovered dead by an accident on the night of the 23rd of October. 20 minutes before the policies expire.
In that case, if he did, Dorian, all I can say is that he's a fool. It's one of the names.
Yes, but that's not all. I've been looking into Mrs. Fox's file pretty carefully. I'll show you one or two other things that might be well worth thinking over.
Mr. Crocker had no difficulty in convincing the investigator that it would be well worthwhile to pay a visit to Margaret. That he was justified was proved a few days later when he had a cryptically worded telegram from the seaside resort reading, "Bathing good, but water very muddy." He might have added, "and fishy," but it shows even an ex-policeman may have a sense of humor. Mr. Crocker's immediate move was to get in touch with Chief Inspector Hambrook of Scotland Yard.
When did Fox take off this policy on his mother's life, Mr. Crocker?
In May this year, Inspector. There's the file. Interesting, isn't it? A daily policy on no fewer than 167 days out of a possible total of 176.
In other words, not a regular life insurance policy, just the kind that's normally sold to people at railway stations and on board ships to cover them during the trip.
That's it.
No medical examination required?
No, just sign on the dotted line.
Weren't you suspicious when he kept on having the policy renewed day after day?
Not particularly. Insurance companies often have to deal with eccentric customers of this kind. But there's a more interesting point. Fox asked all kinds of questions about the correct definition of the clause referring to accidental death.
Oh, did he, by Jove?
Wanted to know, for instance, if his mother was drowned in her bath, would that be an accident within the meaning of the policy? What was the position if she was poisoned by food served in a restaurant?
Evidently wanted to make sure of his ground.
And remember, on top of everything else, Mrs. Fox was pronounced dead only 20 minutes before the policy was due to expire.
Yes. Now I've got some information for you. I've had dealings with Sidney Fox before. Made a copy of his record before coming along here. Take a look at it. Starts when he was 11 or 12. Defrauded a greengrocer at Brighton. Matter put into the hands of the police and Sidney was burnt.
Doesn't seem to have made much of an impression on him.
No. A couple of years later, he had to do 3 months hard labor. A year later, 8 months of forgery. A year later, 6 months of victimizing London stores. 2 years more, and then 12 months of obtaining credit from a London hotel by fraud. Out of prison a year, then 12 months hard labor for larceny and fraud. Stays out of trouble for 3 years, and then back to prison for 15 months for stealing jewelry.
Well, I haven't heard. He's a bad egg.
He is, indeed.
Well, our investigator down at Margate says that in the beginning, Fox had everybody's sympathy.
Well, it just shows you how easily people are taken in, huh? Yes, I think a visit to the seaside is clearly indicated for me.
I thought you'd feel that way about it.
Meantime, Mr. Harding, the manager of the Metropole Hotel, you remember, and his wife had done a lot of careful thinking. They talked things over, with the result that their opinion of Mr. Sidney Fox had changed completely. When Chief Inspector Hambrook arrived in Margate and got in touch with the Chief Constable, he was amazed to find that as a result of a warrant sworn out by Mr. Harding, Fox was already under arrest. Sidney Fox, the young man who at first had aroused everybody's sympathy as a devoted son suffering a terrible bereavement, has been unmasked as a petty criminal. And, if I may say so, an extremely foolish one at that. To make a claim on a daily policy 20 minutes before it had expired and hope to escape suspicion seems sheer lunacy to me. Don't you think so, Hoskins?
But that didn't hang.
No. No, the tiny slip, which might have been made by a far more intelligent man, did that. Now, as I told you, Fox was under arrest when Inspector Hambrook arrived at Margate. And he immediately called a conference of Harding, the hotel manager, his wife, and Chief Constable.
I'd better explain how I come into the picture, Inspector. You see, just after the inquest, I had a call at my headquarters from a landlady who had recently let rooms to Mrs. Fox and her son.
Well, here in Margate, huh?
That's right. She couldn't understand how they could afford to take accommodation at a place like the Metropole, and they hadn't been able to pay her bill.
Well, that was careless of them.
Hadn't paid her a penny piece.
But Fox paid your bill, Mr. Harding?
No, he hasn't. Matter of fact, that's why he's in jail.
Although at first, my husband and I didn't like the press about the money he owed us because of what he'd been through.
No, it didn't seem right. Particularly when he tells us that story about all his money being lost in the fire.
Oh, that was a neat one.
Oh, he's vulnerable, all right. Said his money was in his mother's purse, which got burnt. Well, I looked at that purse. I got it back at the station. You can see it for yourself. It is burnt on the outside, all right, but the inside's intact.
Caught him out on that one, all right.
But still, it wasn't because of the money we agreed to have him arrested.
No, it wasn't because of the money. It was another thing. You see, while the doctor was trying to revive Mrs. Fox, the young man was with me, and I was doing my best to try and calm him. Oh, he's in a terrible state.
Real or pretended?
Well, it seemed real enough at the time. And you know how it is when you try to, well, comfort a person. I found myself stroking his hair. Very thick, bushy hair he had. Sometime later, I smelt smoke on my hand.
Now, I was there when she found out about it. Quite strong. We just looked at each other and we could feel the same awful suspicion growing in each of our minds.
I don't quite understand why it should impress you like that. Probably you didn't realize that smoke clings to the hair.
Well, but that's just it. He hadn't been into the room.
Oh. How do you know?
He said so in front of all of us. Not once, but several times.
Well, he was quite clear about it. Said he opened the door, saw the smoke, closed the door, and ran for help.
The door was closed when we got there.
While Mr. Dickens was rescuing Mrs. Fox, the son was with me on the opposite side of the corridor.
I've got a good head of hair, and for the short time it took to get the old lady out of there, I was in the smoke much more than he was. But the smell of it wasn't in my hair as thick as that, was it, dear?
No, it certainly was not.
Oh, I see now. It can only mean one thing. Young Fox must have been in that smoke-filled room for some considerable time before he came running out calling for help.
It seemed to me it would be best to put Mr. Fox where I could lay my hands on him at any time. So that's how it came about that my request, Mr. Harding took out a warrant against him for obtaining food and accommodation on the Fox pretenses.
Ah, good work. Now, first of all, I'd like to have a look at that room in which Mrs. Fox met with her unfortunate accident. If it was an accident.
Yes, well, that's the trouble.
Why? Everything's been left as it was, isn't it?
I'm afraid not, Inspector. Two or three of the guests helped me to get the damaged stuff out.
All of it?
Well, as long as the chair and the carpet and most of the clothing that had been hung on the chair, we took it down the yard at the back of the hotel. Simply couldn't leave it inside the place.
Well, it was still smoldering.
I see. Yeah, of course. No, you couldn't. Yes. Well, what happened to all those bits and pieces?
Well, they sent the dustman round next day and took it away.
It is all sent to the corporation rubbish heap.
We've got to get that room back into as nearly as possible the same state that it was immediately after the fire. What about that rubbish, sir? Can it be traced?
We can try. It's been some time now. We don't let that stuff lie around long, no.
I'm going to find it if we have to upturn every rubbish dump in the town and search it from top to bottom.
The rubbish was traced to a dump, which was to form part of the foundation of a new promenade road from Margate to the neighboring town of Westcote. I say, you never know what you're stepping on, do you? Tons of other rubbish had already been deposited along with it. There was no indication in what spot the debris from Mrs. Fox's room had been buried. To locate it seemed obviously a hopeless task. To me, the incredible thing is that it was found. Yes, nearly everything was recovered and replaced in Mrs. Fox's room until it closely resembled a scene on the night of the fatal fire. The armchair in which her son said the old lady had sat reading before she hobbled to bed was back in its original position upon a large patch of the burnt, smoked, blackened carpet. The pitiful remnants of her clothing, even a large pile of charred newspapers, were back in place.
One thing has been proved beyond a doubt. A fact that justifies all the work we've undertaken. That fire began underneath the armchair. There's no possible way it could have spread from the gas fire, as was supposed, without charring the carpet and the floorboards in between.
Which would have been the case if the paper the old lady had dropped had been the source of the blaze.
Right, sir. Point two. It has been proved that paper alone could not have set fire to the chair and the carpet. And the volumes of dense oily smoke all the witnesses state filled this room could not have been caused unless some inflammable substance had been added to the blaze. We now know that Fox was in the habit of keeping a bottle of petrol with which to clean the one suit he possessed.
To sum up, it was no accident.
I believe we can provide even further proof of that.
Do?
Yes. I don't believe the old lady was breathing before the fire started.
What?
She was already dead. There's only one way to find out for sure.
A post-mortem, eh?
Yes.
All right. I'll arrange for it.
I regret having to do this. But if she died as a result of smoke suffocation, there'll be soot in her breathing organs and traceable quantities of carbon monoxide in the blood.
And so the coffin was lifted from his resting place and carried to the mortuary, where the pathologist made their examination.
Not a sign of soot or any other effects of smoke. Nor is there any trace of carbon monoxide in the blood.
Oh, then Mrs. Fox was definitely dead before the fire started?
No, I can't go as far as that. What I can say definitely is that before the smoke reached her, she had ceased breathing.
There's a point there. In other words, it's remotely possible that she could have died of, say, a heart failure from the shock of seeing that her room was on fire.
Not impossible, but extremely unlikely. Furthermore, there are bruises on the larynx and the tongue.
What? You mean strangulation?
Looks like it. I'm pretty sure the marks on her tongue were caused by her false teeth. By the way, where are they?
Well, haven't you got them?
No, I imagine they were among your exhibits.
Yeah. But after what you've told me, I'll make it my business to recover them.
The inspector hurried back to the hotel. Neither the manager nor his wife knew anything about the missing set of false teeth, but they immediately started inquiries among the staff. The inspector and chief constable waited impatiently.
Almost anything might have happened to them.
Oh, it's always the same when you get started on a case late. Vital evidence gets scattered and as often as not, never recovered.
Oh, you, Inspector. They've been found.
They have, Mrs. Harding?
Yes. One of the maids who helped clear up Mrs. Fox's room found them on the wash basin.
On the wash basin? Oh, wait a minute. Is she sure of that?
Absolutely. Not knowing what to do with them, she put them away in a cupboard, meaning to ask me. But although she's a very reliable girl, she forgot.
Can we depend on her testimony?
Oh, I'm sure of it. And she's quite definite. They were on that wash basin immediately after the fire.
Now, that clinches my case. How could a woman who could barely walk unaided go across the room and put her false teeth on the wash basin when the marks on her tongue proved that she was wearing them at the time of her death?
Couldn't be done.
No, sir. So you can make out another warrant for our friend, Mr. Fox. This time, the charge is murder.
And so Sidney Fox was brought up for trial. Trial for his life. You remember the bruises on the throat mentioned by the pathologist. Medical men all over the country, skilled in forensic medicine, gave their interpretations of the cause for those bruises. And as so often happens, hardly any two of them agreed. Fox had his own alibi for the bruises. A few days before the fire, he had thoughtfully taken occasion to tell some of the hotel staff about what he airily described as a sham fight he'd had with his mother. Apparently, he hoped that this childish subterfuge might counter any suspicions the bruises would arouse if they were discovered after his mother's death. What credulous fools criminals must think the rest of us are. But in spite of Fox's opinion of his own cleverness, the passage in the trial most damaging to his chance of acquittal came when he was caught in a verbal trap by the Attorney General who was conducting the cross-examination for the prosecution.
Now, Fox, we come to the moment when you opened the door to your mother's room and discovered the fire. I want you to be very careful about this. Was it full of smoke when you opened the door?
So thick that I couldn't possibly have gone in there without suffocating. I knew I couldn't live in there.
So you closed the door and immediately ran for help?
That's exactly what I did.
So you knew your mother was already dead?
No. No. How could I know that?
You closed the door.
I didn't want the smoke to spread through the hotel.
But if you didn't know your mother was already dead, closing that door meant you condemned her to certain death by suffocation. Why, you ran for help.
I went for help to get her out.
You overlooked the fact that the natural thing to do would be to fling wide the door so that the smoke would escape. You overlooked that, didn't you?
That wasn't it. No.
Fox, you closed that door.
I don't know that I did close it. I wasn't thinking when I said that.
Both Mr. Harding and Mr. Dickens have testified that the door was closed when you returned. No one was there to close it if you didn't. Closing the door shows you knew the smoke could no longer hurt your mother. No, you knew your mother would never breathe again, didn't you?
You trapped me into this. It's a trap. I can think of an explanation if I'm given time.
But the sands of time had almost run out for Sidney Fox. No words uttered by a man on trial for his life could have acknowledged his guilt more clearly. Sidney Fox paid the extreme penalty for the murder of his mother. To me, the most interesting character in the case is the victim, Mrs. Fox. What sort of a woman was she? Or rather, what sort of a mother was she? Can't be rather inclined to condemn a poor, wretched creature like her son and not look for the cause.
My dear Clive, if we started doing that, how would the law work? You're right, though. Mrs. Fox was a weak, lazy woman, and shut her eyes to thoughts she must have seen in the son. Worse than that, when he was a kid, she did her best to spoil him.
Spoil him? My goodness. He certainly succeeded in that, all right. Yes, he sounds like a mother's boy, going to Mrs. Harding for comfort and letting her stroke his hair. You know, that's rather ironic. Tiny slip that brought his downfall.
There's no doubt of that. If the Harding suspicions had not been aroused, Fox would have been free to escape. And with the delay, the debris from the room of the murder would have been buried beyond recovery.
So it comes about that in Scotland Yard's grim black museum, there is no memento of this famous case. For how can you capture a thing so ephemeral, although in this case so deadly, as a smell of smoke clinging to a kindly woman's hat?
Autolite resistor spark plugs are ignition engineered by Autolite, which makes more than 400 products for cars, trucks, airplanes, and boats in 28 plants from coast to coast. Autolite also makes complete electrical systems for many makes of America's finest cars. All ignition engineered to fit together perfectly, work together perfectly, because they're a perfect team. The lifeline of your car. So, folks, don't accept electrical parts that are supposed to be as good. Remember, you're right with Autolite.
The show, The Hall of Fantasy, has a sort of checkered history. You see, there were several shows that went by that name. Now, that's kind of fair because all were produced and written by Richard Thorne, who, by the way, also acted in many of the shows. In its first incarnation, it originated from radio station KALL in Salt Lake City, Utah. Richard had worked there as an announcer from late 1946 and early 1947. This particular series consisted of 26 shows. The air dates of these shows are entirely uncertain. Most of them are classic murder mysteries, culminating in the villain getting his due. Apparently only 6 of these shows survive. In 1949, Richard was living in Chicago, and he revived The Hall of Fantasy. A bit different. This time the series featured stories involving struggles against the supernatural. This series contains 112 shows and was aired locally on station WGN. Then in 1953, The Hall of Fantasy was picked up by the Mutual Network for all of 39 shows. For this show, Thorne wrote original stories and adapted classical works. Again, he played many of the lead characters. This episode appears to be from that period. It's a very spooky, rather atmospheric tale, and a pretty good example of this series, in which Uncle Amos is dying. And as he dies, he speaks his mind to those who will inherit his fortune, his estate. He also tells them he's going to come back from the grave to right the wrongs they've done him. I wish dead people would just stay put. It's very annoying when they don't.
And now, The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to The Hall of Fantasy. Welcome to the series of radio dramas dedicated to the supernatural, the unusual, and the unknown. Come with me, my friends. We shall descend to the world of the unknown and forbidden, down to the depth where the veil of time is lifted and the supernatural reigns as king. Come with me and listen to the tale of The Black Figurine of Death, an original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne.
Is that you, David?
Yes, I heard a shot.
So did we.
I thought it was one of you.
Yeah, I saw you.
He came out late tonight. I found him out in the mausoleum about an hour ago.
Here's his room.
Try the door.
It's open.
Oh, he's on the floor.
Is he?
Yes. He's dead.
Through all the years of man's existence, no matter what he has learned or been taught from generation to generation, still he carries in the innermost depths of his mind a certain fear of the darkness, a fear of the night, which is somehow associated with death, and which in actuality is the fear of death itself. Each of us in his lifetime will probably come in contact with some psychic phenomenon, either directly or indirectly through the experience of a relative or acquaintance. An experience never to be forgotten. And about such an experience is my story tonight. I was there with the others the night he died. We stood at the foot of the bed, Joyce and Harold and I. Amos Jansen's head was cushioned on a pillow, and in his hand he held a little figurine.
You sent for us, Uncle Amos?
Of course I did. Otherwise you wouldn't be here in my room, Harold.
No, Uncle Amos is no...
Be quiet! Be quiet, all of you. You're here too, David.
Yes, sir, I...
I didn't ask for a speech, young man. I'll do the talking if you don't mind. I must speak to all of you while I still have time.
Why don't you rest, Uncle Amos?
Rest? You'd like to see that, wouldn't you, Joyce? David, Harold, what? No answer from any of you? I know why you can't say anything, because it's the truth.
Now, see here, Uncle Amos.
Don't listen to me, young man. These last years of my life, you've all left me alone. You've had more important things to do. That is, until tonight. Tonight you're all here because you know I'm dying. You've come here like a pack of wolves, waiting for me to die, waiting for your chance to inherit my estate.
Oh, that's not true, Uncle Amos.
Oh, isn't it? I think it is. Don't worry. You'll inherit the estate, the three of you. But in the end, you'll wish you never had.
What do you mean, Uncle Amos?
That though I die, you'll see me again. All of you who've hated me. And you'll know of my presence when you see this.
Oh, that's just a little figurine, Uncle Amos.
You'll wish you'd never seen it before I'm through. You'll wish that you'd never known me, that you'd never been born. Before you die, you'll all learn what fear is. You'll learn how it feels to be... alone.
Uncle Amos...
He's dead, George.
Oh, no. Oh, no, he can't.
He's dead, all right.
What's that?
Something dropped out of his hand. Why? Just a little figurine. The little figurine lay there on the floor. It had fallen from Uncle Amos's hand just as he died. And when it struck the floor, it had broken into three pieces. I picked them up and held them in my hand. The pieces fitted together perfectly, much like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. It was a queer little figure, its arms raised in supplication, a look of fear upon its face. There was something frightening about it. 3 days later, Uncle Amos was buried in the family mausoleum at the north end of the estate. A week after that, we had gathered again in the library of the old house with Carl Sawyer, the executor of the estate.
As you know, your uncle appointed me as executor of the estate and left instructions that the three main heirs, 10 days following his demise, be gathered together in this house for a reading of the will.
You told us that earlier, Mr. Sawyer.
So I did. Are you all seated comfortably?
Quite comfortably, Mr. Sawyer.
It's a rather long will, you know. Now, I shall begin. I, Amos Johnson, being of sound mind and body, do make, ordain, and publish this instrument as my last will and...
Mr. Sawyer, why don't you just tell us about the will?
That's a rather unusual procedure, David.
Well, David's right, Mr. Sawyer. It'll save a lot of time and trouble.
Well, perhaps you're right. Let me see. Now, referring to the disposition of the monies and property... It's to be divided equally amongst the three of you. Of course, there are certain gifts to the servants.
Naturally.
Yes, naturally. There is a considerable amount of money to be divided, even after taxes. Each of you will be independent for life.
I can't understand Uncle Amos willing us the entire estate. The night he died...
Contrary to what you may think, your Uncle Amos was really quite fond of you.
Is that all to the will, Mr. Sawyer?
No. Of course, you realize that if one of you were to die, his or her share of the estate would be divided between the two remaining heirs. And there is one other proviso which I cannot quite understand.
Yes?
Your uncle made one condition referring to the disposition of the monies. Let me see if I can find that. Yes. Here it is. May I read it, please? The heirs are to reside in the family house on the estate for a period of 1 year. If this is not done, their claim to the estate is to be nullified, and they are to be left without a penny. Unfortunately, they were present very infrequently during the last years of my life.
Well, that's a rather strange provision.
Yes, isn't it? However, as executor of your uncle's will, it is up to me to make sure the provisions are carried out. And believe me, I feel a deep sense of duty to your late uncle.
Four of us discussed the will until the early hours of the morning. We persuaded Sawyer to spend the night with us.
to return to the city in the morning. The house became quite silent, and the only sound I heard was the ticking of the clock on my dresser. I wondered about the provision of the will in which Uncle Amos ordered that we make our residence in his house. I was lying awake in bed thinking of that when... Standing outside my door in the hallway was the housekeeper.
Mr. David?
Yes, Emily.
I found this in my bedroom tonight.
Oh, let me see it.
Here.
Mm-hmm. It's a little black figurine, just like the one my uncle had. You can have it back now, Emily.
It frightened me, so I came to you, Mr. David.
How do you think it got there, Emily?
There's something strange going on in this house, Mr. David. And I have an idea. I know who's in bed.
Who's talking out there? Oh, it's you, David. And Emily. You're up rather late, aren't you?
Yes, Mr. Sawyer. I was just going to bed. If you'll excuse me.
Good night, Emily.
Good night, sir. I'll see you in the morning.
Well, I suppose I'd better get back to bed, too. Good night, David.
Good night, Mr. Sawyer. I watched him go back into his room. Then I turned and went back into mine. Emily had been on the point of saying something to me. Something that was important enough to her to make a special trip to my room. I got back into bed. Wondered what she'd wanted to tell me. Little by little, sleep clouded my brain. And I was half asleep.
Sawyer, I heard someone scream.
So did I, David.
Sawyer, I heard something.
I know I did. There's David and Mr. Sawyer. Maybe they can tell us what happened.
Did you two hear anything?
It was a scream. First, I thought it might have been you, Joyce.
I think it came from the servants' quarters.
Emily.
What did you say, David?
It'll keep. Come on. You think it was the housekeeper, David?
It has to be.
Maybe she was just startled or something.
Well, we'll see in a moment.
No, that's a room just down the hall.
I hope it's nothing serious. It was serious enough to make her scream. Emily! Emily, is anything wrong?
Well, try the door, David.
Right. It's a lock.
The light's on in there.
She's not in bed. She's...
Oh, on the floor!
Maybe she fainted.
No. She's dead.
And look. Right beside her. There's a little broken... figurine.
Though the police came out and went over everything, there were no clues to follow. They said that Emily had been strangled, but there was nothing to indicate who might have done it. The police continued their investigation for almost a month. But at the end of that time, all they could write down in their casebook was murder unsolved. One evening, about 6 weeks after Emily's death, Harold, Joyce, and I were in the living room. The police said they'd never be able to find out who did it unless something new turned up. And it probably won't.
Oh, the whole thing frightens me. I still remember Uncle Amos's dying words. That though I die, you'll see me again. All of you who have hated me. And you'll know of my presence when you see this. What makes me shudder every time I think of it?
I've been thinking about what he said, too, Joyce. I wonder if he could come back.
You mean come back after death?
Yes.
Don't be a fool, Harold. Once a man dies, he's dead.
Is he? I'm not so sure of that.
You shouldn't talk that way, Harold. It's frightening.
Would you come out with me to the mausoleum, Dave?
Why?
I don't know. I just want to check, that's all.
Well, I don't think either of you should go.
I'll go, Harold.
Well, I won't.
That's all right, Joyce. Someone expects you to. All right, David, let's go. I've always had an interest in the supernatural, David. You know, there's certain things that happen, psychic phenomena, which have no normal or natural explanation.
I've never seen any.
Nor have I. But what's to say that Uncle Amos can't return? Oh, you got the key?
Yeah.
Open the door.
It's a good thing we brought these flashlights.
Yes, it's pretty dark in there. Shall we go in?
I guess so. I still don't see any reason for coming in here, Harold.
There may not be. Then again, He's in that crypt over there. Nothing's been disturbed in here. It looks just like it did the day he was placed here. Just a minute.
This wasn't here the day he was buried.
What? This? That's strange. I didn't see that when I came in. You probably weren't looking over there. I wasn't either. Another little black figurine. Broken just like the others. It gave me an eerie sensation. The little figure was broken into three pieces. I looked at Harold, and he seemed to be as afraid as I was. We locked up the mausoleum again and went back to the house. By that time, I began to wonder if perhaps Uncle Amos was striking back at us from beyond the grave. We said goodnight about 11 and retired to our rooms. I couldn't get to sleep. I'd fall into a half-doze and then snap out of it again. I felt as if someone were watching me. That there were unseen eyes in the dark waiting for me to fall asleep. I knew it was only my imagination. Yet that feeling would not go away. About 3 o'clock, I got out of bed. I decided to return to the mausoleum. As I went out the front door, I noticed a light drizzle had sprung up. Something drew me toward the mausoleum, a compulsion, an inner force over which I had absolutely no control. I walked slowly up the gravel walk leading to the mausoleum, not even noticing the light rain which fell on me. When I was close enough to see the doorway, I received a distinct shock. For the door was open, and there was a circle of light behind it. I walked to the door. I tried to get through the door quietly, but I jarred it a little, and the noise made the man inside whirl around. In his hand, he held a gun.
David! David! What are you doing here?
I might ask you the same question, Mr. Sire.
I began to wonder. I don't believe in people coming back after they die, but...
Is that the reason for the gun?
I didn't know what I'd find. I wanted to be safe, that's all. Now that I see it's you, I'll put it back in my pocket. By the way, David, what are you doing out here?
I was restless. Harold thinks everything that's happened has some supernatural significance. All his talk made me nervous.
I see. And do you think that there is something supernatural about the way Emily died?
I don't know, Mr. Sawyer. I just don't know. Sawyer and I returned to the house. I asked him to spend the remainder of the night with us. Besides, I wanted to keep an eye on him. I didn't feel much like sleeping, so I went down to the library, picked out a book, and sat down to read.
David?
Yes?
Mr. Sawyer told me you were down here. What's the matter?
I can't sleep.
David, I talked to Mr. Sawyer for almost 10 minutes. He said he thinks that you're in back of everything.
What did you say to that?
I told him I thought he was wrong.
Thanks for your confidence, Joyce.
The more I think about it, the more I think that Harold's right in what he says.
You mean that Uncle Amos has come back to life?
Yes.
I'd keep an eye on Sawyer if I were you.
Do you think he's in back of it?
I'm not sure.
But you must have some reason for it.
I went out to the mausoleum tonight about an hour ago. Sawyer was out there. He had a gun in his hand.
He told me he was just curious.
Why should he suddenly get curious at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Well, it does seem rather odd that he...
No! Stay away from me. I don't want to move. Stay away.
That was Sawyer. Come on.
It couldn't happen again. It's just a
couple of teams. Is that you, David?
Yes. I heard a shot.
But so did we.
I thought it was one of you.
Sawyer.
He came out late tonight. I found him out in the mausoleum about an hour ago.
Here's his room.
Try the door.
It's open.
On the floor.
Is he? the floor, sprawled in the grotesque position of death. By one outstretched hand was a gun, and by the other, broken into three pieces, was a little black figurine. Harold called the police. They said they'd be out as soon as they could. The three of us went downstairs to the living room. I was right. It is Uncle Amos who's behind it.
There must be. There's no other explanation.
I told you before that there are certain things which can never be explained. The deaths of Emily and Sawyer prove that.
You don't still think that Sawyer was in back of it, do you, David?
Hardly. Will or no will, I'm leaving here now. I'm not going to stay around here and be killed like the others. I'm going upstairs and back. I'll be down in a while.
I'm going to leave too, David. What about you?
I don't know. I still can't make myself believe.
David!
Stay here.
Oh, no, I'll go with you. Harold, stand up.
He has to be all right. Harold! Harold!
Don't answer.
Harold, where are you?
Harold! Don't answer us.
His door's open.
He'll be dead. He'll be dead just like the others.
No, Joyce, he's not here.
The mausoleum. Uncle Amos came and took him back to the mausoleum.
I went into Sawyer's room. Harold wasn't there, nor was Sawyer's gun. I supposed that Harold had picked it up on his way to the room. I decided to go out to the mausoleum to see if Joyce was right, to see if Harold's dead body would be found there. Joyce wouldn't remain in the house alone, so together we started out through the rain-filled night.
Why don't we wait until the police come, Dave?
If this is something supernatural, then they wouldn't be able to help us anyway.
Dave,
what's the matter?
Mausoleum door is open.
You can stay here if you want. I'm going in.
I'll go with you.
Stay close to me, Joyce.
I will. I don't like it in here, David.
Neither do I. But you're going to remain here for some time.
That was Harold's voice.
That's right. But turn the flashlight on. You can see me then.
But we thought you...
Dead? Hardly. But you two will be very soon.
It's a gun, David.
That's right, Sawyer's gun. Plan this very carefully, David. When the police arrive, they'll find the three of you dead, and I'll be wounded. Tell them that Sawyer was behind it all, that he killed both of you out here, but he came into the house searching for me. It was a fight. The gun went off. And he died.
Then you killed Emily and Sawyer.
Yes. I'm going to kill both of you, too. I don't think I believed all that hokum I fed you about Uncle Amos coming back, do you? Of course not. It served its purpose. Now you'll serve yours.
Phil, look out in back of
you. How stupid do you think I am?
Uncle Amos is coughing and slipping.
Get out of the way, Phil.
Get out of the way.
He's dead, Joyce.
Uncle Amos.
What did you say?
I remember what Uncle Amos said when he was dying. That he'd come back and settle with us. The coffin. I wonder if it was just an accident that it slipped out of the crypt. Or whether Uncle Amos really did come back.
The terrifying, the unknown. Join us again when next we journey down the corridors of the Hall of Fantasy to hear another strange tale of the supernatural. All characters and events portrayed in these programs are fictional, and any similarity to actual events or persons, living or dead, is purely coincidental.
The Dead Priest by P.U. Sungling. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. A certain Taoist priest, overtaken in his wanderings by the shades of evening, sought refuge in a small Buddhist monastery. The monk's apartment was, however, locked, so he threw his mat down in the vestibule of the shrine and seated himself upon it. In the middle of the night, when all was still, he heard a sound of someone opening the door behind him, and looking round, he saw a Buddhist priest, covered with blood from head to foot, who did not seem to notice that anybody else was present. Accordingly, he himself pretended not to be aware of what was going on, and then he saw the other priest enter the shrine, mount the altar, and remain there some time, embracing Buddha's head and laughing by turns. When morning came, he found the monk's room still locked, and suspecting something was wrong, he walked into a neighboring village, where he told the people what he had seen. Thereupon the villagers went back with him, and broke open the door, and there before them lay the priest weltering in his blood, having evidently been killed by robbers, who had stripped the place bare, anxious now to find out what had made the disembodied spirit of the priest laugh in the way it had been seen to do. They proceeded to inspect the head of Buddha on the altar, and at the back of it, they noticed a small mark, scraping through which they discovered a sum of over 30 ounces of silver. This sum was forthwith used for defraying the funeral expenses of the murdered man.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Tell you, Janice, it's got to be Slick.
No, it won't work, Roger. It's too uncertain.
But there's nothing to go wrong. Now listen, those custom boys are used to naive, stupid smuggling. We've got to be smart, that's all.
And you think your idea is?
Look, Janice, why isn't it? We get on the boat. We're strangers. We never speak to each other. No one on the boat can connect us in any way. Now, I get off first, and right away I have my trunk and bags examined. By the time I'm through, you're off and you're waiting. Then...
Yes, but that timing. How can I be sure there won't be a lot of people on the ladder G and only me at K?
For heaven's sake, Janice, you can stall somehow. We'll be near enough to each other to see how things are going.
Okay, okay.
Then I pick up my 3 bags and walk over toward you. I'm clumsy and I don't see where I'm going. I bump into you, and as I do, you drop my wallet. I pick it up.
With your hands full of bags, I suppose.
Well, maybe you pick it up. We don't have to rehearse a scene like that. If anyone thinks he sees you drop it, my initials and identification will prove it's mine, especially as I've just been through the customs. It'll look as if I had it in my hands.
Sounds good, Roger.
Good. It's perfect. Why, with the diamond market the way it is, we'll clean up in America, honey.
Roger, if this works, you're a genius.
That all you want to declare, Mr. Griswold?
That's all.
You're clear then, Mr. Griswold. Guess you're glad to be home.
I certainly am. More than you can guess.
Yeah, it must be pretty tough in Lisbon, even for Americans. Oh, can you manage that packing by yourself?
Oh, yes, thanks. I must be clumsy about this now. Ah, there's Janice, good girl. She's just arrived. Fine. Well, here we go.
Oh!
I beg your pardon.
Look where you're going. Oh, just a minute. I think you dropped this wallet.
What? Oh, yes, yes. I guess I did. Oh, thanks very much.
Wait a minute there. He didn't drop that, miss. You did.
Oh, no, you're mistaken. That isn't my wallet.
Well, indeed it isn't.
I saw you drop it, miss. Say, what's going on here?
Oh, nothing's going on. This gentleman ran into me and dropped his wallet, and I picked it up, and that's all.
How do you know it's his wallet?
Well, because his initials are on it.
Oh, they are they? What are your names?
Janice Kite.
I'm Roger Griswold, but I don't
Well,
see...
Janice Kite and Roger Griswold, you're both under arrest for smuggling. How did the customs official discover their trick? In just a minute, we'll hear.
Yeah, you got it. This is a break. We'll be back real soon.
And now, back to our story.
Look here, you can't arrest me for smuggling.
Well, you remember I asked you, Miss Kite, how you knew it was his wallet that had dropped.
Yes.
You said you knew it was his because his initials were on it.
Well, aren't they?
Yes, his initials are there, all right, but on the inside. And when the wallet dropped to the floor, it didn't fall open so you couldn't have seen them. Therefore, I knew you had previous knowledge of them. Yes, you two had a nice little package of 15 diamonds in that wallet. And now, how about a free ride to the station house?
Most of us, I think, know about X-1. It's generally considered to be the best science fiction drama ever produced for radio. It wasn't the first. There were a couple of them before them, including X-1's direct ancestor, Dimension X. It ran from 1955 to 1958 on NBC and was generally composed of adaptations of recently published science fiction stories, mostly from Galaxy Science Fiction magazine, and were generally written by the leading writers of the time, people like Philip K. Dick, Fritz Lieber, J.G. McIntosh, Robert Heinlein, Ted Sturgeon. Tonight is the adaptation of a James Gunn story from June the 26th of 1956. I admit that James Gunn is not as well known as those other guys. He, however, does have one distinction that is not borne by many of those guys. He's still alive. He was born in 1923 and has had a distinguished career beyond science fiction writer. I mean, he's been an editor and a scholar. He's been an anthropologist. He's produced a lot of science fiction and a number of scholarly books, including The Road to Science Fiction. He's won Hugo Awards, one for the nonfiction book, Isaac Asimov, The Foundations of Science Fiction, and has been named a Damon Knight Memorial Grand Master by the Science Fiction Writers Association of America. He is Professor Emeritus of English and the Director of the Center for the Study of Science Fiction, both at the University of Kansas. If you're old enough, you may remember the ABC television program, The Immortal, which ran in 1970 for a year or two, I don't remember. That was based on a James Gunn novel, The Immortals. There's a new playhouse in 1959 based Man in Orbit on James Gunn's short story, Cave of Night. I personally have fond memories of many of his novels, particularly his first novel, This Fortress World, which is about a future church that has turned to using hidden technology to support their claims of the miraculous. When I read the book, probably around 1961 or two, I thought this was an interesting and very novel idea. It wouldn't be until much later that I would learn that this was in fact an old story, this usage of technology to fool the masses. Many of man's earliest and most ingenious inventions were used by the priesthood in this manner. You should read up on Hero of Alexandria, for example. This story is based on James Gunn's 1953 novella, Wherever You May Be, and was adapted by Ernest Canoy. By the way, this same story was made into an episode of a Russian science fiction TV series, This Fantastic World, in 1989, and was entitled The Psychodynamics of Witchcraft. Wherever You May Be is entirely a fantasy, and that's not a good title, I think. I really don't know why it is named Wherever You May Be, particularly in the context of this radio play. Gunn himself originally called it The Reluctant Witch, but the name was changed by Galaxy Magazine when they published it in May of 1953.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3... 2, X minus 1, fire.
From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of the future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X minus one.
Tonight, Wherever You May Be, by James E. Gunn.
Hey. Hey, you. A little girl. You on the fence.
Yeah.
Hey, kid, come here.
Well, I'm right comfortable where I am.
Oh. Listen, kid. Is there a service station on this road?
Well, Merv Wheelock got a gas pump at the general store.
Oh? How far is it?
About 18 miles.
Oh, that's a big help. Well, I don't know what else to expect in the middle of the Ozarks.
You want me to help you, mister?
No, just keep out of the way, kid. Ow! Well, there's nothing funny about that. You just gonna sit there and watch me sweat, kid?
Oh, no. There'll be lots more to watch.
Well, I don't know what's so amusing about watching a man change a flat tire. Ow!
You sure you don't want me to help, mister?
No, I'm perfectly capable of changing a tire by myself.
Mister, it's rolling away.
What?
Your tire. It's rolling away.
Hey, come back here, you. Well, this is the most sadistic tire I ever... Now, stay put. Why don't you go home?
Can't.
Why not?
I run away.
Oh, well, that's tough. There. Now, listen, kid. You know a cabin about 15 miles up the road?
I reckon.
You know where the turnoff is?
There ain't no turnoff. You just drive till the road peters out and you take the footpath. You gonna live in that place?
Mm-hmm. Just for the summer.
Oh.
Well, so long, kid.
Oh, mister. Hey, mister.
Now what do you want?
Well, nothing. Only you forgot your jack.
Oh, that does it. Where are you going?
No place.
But you said you ran away.
I surely did.
Don't you have any relatives?
No.
Friends?
No.
All right, then, go on home. Oh, come on now. What are you crying for? All right, get in. I'll give you a lift. Now listen, look out for those notes. There's over a year's work in those.
Oh, a year's work in them pieces of paper?
Uh-huh. Those are notes for the thesis I'm going to write.
You write stories?
No, research paper. I have to do it to get my degree at the university.
Well, what's it called? I mean the story you're writing.
It's called The Psychodynamics of Witchcraft with special reference to the Salem Trials of 1692.
Oh, witches?
Yeah. All right, where do you live, kid?
Well, I can't go home. Pa'd beat me again. Oh, he'd pretty nigh skin me alive, I guess.
You mean he hit you? Little kid like you?
Well, he... don't use his fists. Not often. He uses his belt mostly. Look here. On my knee. See that black and blue mark? And this one?
Never mind. Why does he hit you?
He's just mean.
Well, he must have some reason.
Oh, he wants me to catch some strong young fellow who'd do the work around the place. A gal don't bring in no money, he says. Leastwise, not a good one.
You're much too young to get married.
I'm 16.
You don't look more than... Well, I don't know.
Most girls my age got a couple of young ones. One, anyways. The way Pa carries on, you'd think I didn't want to get married. Now, it ain't my fault no fellow wants me.
What seems to be the trouble?
Mostly, I guess I'm just unlucky. One fella I went with pretty nearly a year. He busted his leg. Another nigh well drowned when he fell in the lake. Now, it don't seem right they should blame me. even though we did have words.
Blame you?
Well, they say it's caught in disaster instead of a gal. Fellas, just stop coming round. You married
Matthew Wright. No, I'm not married.
Wright. Abigail Wright. That's right, Purdy.
Abigail Wright?
Oh, did I say that? Now, ain't that funny? My name's Jenkins.
Mr. Jenkins? Oh, fine. I met your daughter on the road. I brought her back. Oh. Look, Mr. Jenkins, I got a pint bottle in my pocket. Care for a little drink?
Terrible week.
Well, I'm sorry. I repeat, I brought your daughter back.
Why?
Well, she had no place to go.
She ran away.
Now, look, Mr. Jenkins, I realize that teenage daughters can be a nuisance, and after meeting your daughter, I can understand how you feel. Still and all, she is your daughter.
Got my doubts.
Now, Mr. Jenkins, your daughter may have given you good reason to lose your temper, but beating a child is never sound psychology.
Beat her? You mean wallop her, whale her? Man, I never laid a hand to her. I dastn't.
But she said...
Come in here.
Oh, now, Mr. Jenkins, I assure
come
you...
Come in the cabin. You look around this here room, mister. See them dishes all over the floor, those chairs all splintered like they was kindling, that table turned over bottom side topmost like a turtle on the road? You think I beat her?
Well, the place is a shambles.
I ain't saying Abby did it. But when she gets unhappy, things happen. Dishes come flying through the air. Funny things happen around Ab. Ever since she started filling out 5 or 6 years ago.
Well, she's only 16.
16? Don't let on I told you, but she's past 18. There, you see?
Well, it just fell off the shelf.
Well, look, you're a city fella, passable looking. Why don't you take her with you?
What? Oh, now, wait a minute, Mr. Jenkins.
But she's right pretty when she fixes up, and she can cook right smart. Go on, take her.
Well, you must be mad. You can't give a girl away like that. If you'll excuse me, I think I'd better be going.
Nobody asked you to bring her back. This gal eats more than I do.
Oh, now, look, here. Here's $10. Buy yourself a jug.
Well, I'd like to, but I can't do it. It ain't worth it. You brought her back. You can take her away.
Oh, here. Here's 15.
Well, I should know better. All right, mister.
I'll get her.
It ain't no use, though, I can tell you, mister.
All right, Abigail. Get out of the car. You're home.
But, Pa...
Oh, he isn't mad at you. He's welcoming you back. Now, come on, get out.
Oh, dirty, nasty old man. Serve him right at that bottle he's pulling busted right over his head.
Oh! Goodbye, Abby. And remind me never to see you again. What are you doing here?
Waiting for you.
But listen, this is my cabin. I rented it.
I know. What kept you?
Well, what are you doing here? How did you get here?
Oh, I reckon you're hungry. Look, why don't you sit down? Supper's about ready.
Now, wait a minute. I came here by car. How did you get here?
Well, I rode. Oh, it's lucky I did. This place needed a good sweeping.
Is that your broom?
I know. It was here in the cabin. Pa loaned me a mule. I let her go. She'll get home all right.
But you can't stay here. It's impossible. What would people say?
Well, who'd care? Pa don't. Please, Mr. Wright, let me cook and clean for you. I won't be no trouble. Honest, I wouldn't.
Oh, now look, Abby, you're a nice girl and I like you, but you'll just have to go back to your father, do you understand?
All right.
What? What was that? What happened? Oh, look at that, the car. I must have left the brake off.
You reckon it's hurt bad?
Well, rolling down a 10-foot grade into a tree didn't help it any.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Wright.
Are you? Well, anyway, it looks like you'll have to stay here tonight then, doesn't it?
I reckon.
I could have sworn I put that brake on. Listen, you're going back first thing in the morning.
Oh, sure. Sure, Mr. Wright. I understand.
Abby, tell me something. Who wrecked your father's house?
Libby.
Libby, huh? Who's Libby?
The other me. Mostly I keep her bottled up inside. But when I feel sad and unhappy, I just can't keep her in. Then she just lets loose and goes wild.
Schizo. Abby, where did you get an idea like that?
Well, when I was born, I had a twin sister. Only she died real quick. And when I was bad, my ma used to say Libby would never have been mean or cross or naughty. So when I'd done something bad, I started saying Libby'd done it. I guess after a while, I begun to believe it myself.
Can you control it, Abby?
Not much. You see, when I get feeling mad and mean, things just happen, that's all.
How about a rolling tire?
You sure did look funny. Oh, I was just feeling mean about Pa, I guess, and I took it out on you.
I don't believe it. It's absolutely impossible. It's primitive. It's straight out of Fraser's Golden Bough. There's got to be some explanation. Illusion or hypnosis. There's got to be some physical explanation.
Well, I don't see why. I mean, if a thing just happens, you don't have to explain it. It's just there, ain't it?
All right. Here. Now, make that cup move.
Why?
I want to see you do it.
But I don't want to. I never wanted to do it. It just happened.
Oh, come on, try.
Now, no, Mr. Wright. Look, it never brung me nothing but misery. It's bad enough when you can't help it, but it's worse when you do it on purpose. Nothing good will come of it.
Come on, try. I want you to move that cup. Now, go ahead, Abby. Just move it without touching it.
I can't. I just can't.
Why not? Why can't you?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's because I'm happy.
Oh. You can't move it now.
No.
All right, then get your things. You're going back to your father right now.
No, I ain't going. I can't.
Ah, listen to you. You're a stupid backwoods girl. Can't. What kind of a way of talking is that? You're going back to your father because you're an ignorant, dirty hillbilly. Abby, you did it. You did it. It came right at my head.
Do I have to go back?
Oh, no, sir. Not if you help me. Abby, I've got a hold of something here that... What a thesis! Abby? What's courting like here in the hills?
Oh, sometimes we walk and look at things together and talk a little. But if the night is warm, we just sit and hold hands and whatever.
Like this?
Mr. Wright, do you like me a little bit? Oh, not marrying-like, but friendly-like?
I like you very much, Abby. Very much.
Oh, Mr. Wright. You kiss real pretty.
Abby, what happened to your fellas? I mean, the other boys.
Well, folks said I'd the evil eye. I mean, Hank fell off the roof and broke his leg, and Gene, well, he fell in the lake and liked to drown. It wasn't my fault it was after we'd had words, now, was it?
No.
Why, Mr. Wright, you're shivering. Maybe we'd better go get your jacket.
Abby, tomorrow we're going to drive to Springfield to do some shopping.
Really, Mr. Wright? Why, I ain't never been to Springfield. Oh, ain't that wonderful? Mr. Wright.
Huh. Are you happy, Abby?
Oh, it's the happiest I've ever been in my life. I mean, eating in a fancy restaurant and even dancing and all. And, oh, and now us just sitting here together in the moonlight. I never thought anything like this would happen to me.
Abby, I'm afraid maybe you don't understand.
Well, what do you mean, Mr. Wright?
Oh, you know that dress I bought you? That's for another girl.
What?
Yeah, it's for another girl. I'm gonna marry her. She's about your size, and I thought we could pick it out that way.
Oh, no, Oh, Mr. Wright!
Abby, wait a minute. Where are you going? Wait, I want to talk to you.
No, I'm going to bed.
Matthew Wright, you are a no-good, miserable cad.
You want any more coffee?
You still feel bad, Abby?
You want me to move that cup for you today? I can do it real good.
How do you know?
Well, I just got a feeling. Look.
You can do it now?
Sure, I guess. There, it's getting easier.
Look, Abby, I want to get some things out of the car. I just happen to have them things for tests. There may be other powers.
Well, I don't care much one way or the other, Mr. Wright. If it makes you happy, it's all right with me.
Abby? Abby, where are you? Abby, where did you go? Abby?
Here I am, Mr. Wright.
Abby, where were you?
Springfield.
But that's 50 miles.
I know. I just kind of wished I was there, and then I was. I brought back a frying pan I admired in that hardware store window. Ain't it pretty? Got a real copper bottom.
Didn't you have any trouble getting out of the store without anyone seeing you?
Well, I was outside, but I could see in the back room somehow, too. I knew his name was Albert, and he was doing a crossword puzzle.
Now, how could you tell all that?
Well, I just kind of looked inside of his thinking. Like this.
Wait a minute, Abby, don't.
I could look right inside your thinking now, Mr. Wright.
Abby, wait a minute. Abby?
You wouldn't. You didn't!
Now, wait a minute, Abby. You've got to understand.
I understand everything you've been thinking. You devil! Well, there ain't nothing too bad for anyone to do that.
Well, you've got to let me explain.
You, with your kindness and your city manners. How could you do it? You made me fall in love with you. It was just a trick. You just wanted to make me unhappy, that's all. Why, even Pa was never that mean. I'd as soon marry up with a rattlesnake.
Well, Abby, what are you going to do?
Well, I haven't made up my mind yet, but I'll think of something.
Got to think of some way out of it. She's in that other room thinking what to do to me. I've got to think of some way. No, it's no use. As soon as I think of it, she knows. Oh, got to keep my mind busy. Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as maybe if I could get her father. No. If there are two outs and bases loaded, or men on first and second, and a ball is hit, which, in the opinion of the umpire, can be handled by an infielder, the infield fly rule shall be invoked, and the batter is called out. The base runners may advance at their own peril. Their peril. I've got to think. No,
can
I mustn't
you
think.
Make the cherry pie, Matty boy.
Oh, no, she's absolutely certain now she can do anything she wants to. I've got to act on the spur of the moment, keep my mind crowded with something else. Oh, it's a lovely day. Breathes there a man with soul so dead? 'Twas brillig and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wave. Froggy went a-courting, and he did ride, sword and pistol by his side, ring Tom Body Michikambo. Full fathom five my father lies, of his bones are coral made. Seabirds hourly toll his knell. Hark, I hear them, ding, dong, dell.
That's pretty.
Abby!
Where are we going?
Oh, Abby.
Hmm?
What are you doing here?
I couldn't let you leave without me. I've got plans for you.
Oh?
Very interesting plans.
But how could you tell I left? I was thinking all sorts of other things.
Mm-hmm. Matt, you were thinking some of the cutest little rhymes. Oh, but that was on top.
On top?
Why, sure. Way underneath, I could hear plain what you were thinking about running away in this old car.
Well, then why didn't you stop me? Conk out the motor or something?
Oh, I didn't want to. I told you I could see way down underneath the top of your thinking. And you know what I found there? All the time, even when you were making me unhappy to test all them strange things I learned how to do, way down deep, you're in love with me.
I am.
Surely true. So, we're going to get married.
Are we?
Mm-hmm. There isn't much you can do about it now, is there?
No. No, I suppose not. But, you know, it's a frightening thought getting married to you, Abby. A wife who can read your mind and all the rest.
Oh, I wouldn't worry about it, darling. Why, I can only do those things when I'm downright miserable. Everything will be perfectly all right. Just as long as you keep me happy.
Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you, Wherever You May Be, a story from the pages of Galaxy, written by James E. Gunn and adapted for radio by Ernest Canoy. Featured in the cast were William Redfield, Patsy O'Shea, and Jack Orison. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production. Be sure to hear X-1 1/2 hour earlier next week over most NBC radio stations. Check your local newspaper for the exact time. This is the NBC Radio Network.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. Recording by Dave Acklin. Fairy Tales by Brothers Grimm, The Old Man and His Grandson. There once was a very old man, whose eyes had become dim, his ears dull of hearing, his knees trembled, and when he sat at the table, he could hardly hold the spoon, and spilt the broth upon the tablecloth, or let it run out of his mouth. His son and his son's wife were disgusted at this, so the old grandfather at last had to sit in the corner behind the stove, and they gave him his food in an earthenware bowl, and not even enough of it. And he used to look towards the table with his eyes full of tears. Once, too, his trembling hands could not hold the bowl, and it fell to the ground and broke. The young wife scolded him, but he said nothing and only sighed. Then they brought him a wooden bowl for a few halfpence, out of which he had to eat. They were once sitting thus when the little grandson of 4 years old began to gather together some bits of wood upon the ground. "What are you doing there?" asked the father. "I am making a little trough," answered the child, "for father and mother to eat out of when I am big." The man and his wife looked at each other for a while, and presently began to cry. Then they took the old grandfather to the table, and henceforth always let him eat with them, and likewise said nothing if he did spill a little of anything.
Okay, one last break here, and then we'll be right back. Well, I gotta admit that I don't know much about this show. I don't think anyone does. This particular episode is called July 4th Picnic, And apparently it ran on June the 28th of 1936. Here we go.
In the name of the law, we bring you another of the thrilling stories in this exciting series, taken from actual police case files.
Our story begins on a perfect 4th of July morning in Fort Smith, Arkansas, as a happy family prepares for a picnic to the accompaniment of sputtering firecrackers.
Joe! Joe! Stop shooting off those firecrackers and come and help me.
Now what do you want, Julia?
Bring those chickens and that ham out here on the porch where I can pack them in the basket.
All right, Julia. I'm bringing them. Oh, gosh, how I hate these 4th of July picnics.
Like a bear hates honey, you hate them. Now put those fried chickens here on the bench.
Those chickens look good enough to eat.
Land sakes, what do you think of frying them for? Now, Mary and the others will be here any minute. We've got to hurry if we want to get the big clear creek in time for dinner. But with the crowds on the road and all.
Oh, gosh, Julia, I'd rather eat my victuals here at home on the porch. Sit out where the ants begin.
That's what you all would say, Joe Barrett. But we couldn't keep you away from a picnic unless we put you in a straitjacket.
Just a fugitive from a picnic, that's me. Well, here you are. Here's the ham.
Ham.
And the cheese. Mm-hmm. And the jelly. And the coffee. And the... Hey, where's the tomatoes?
In your hand, Joe, as usual. Rack them up in wax paper. Mary just loves nice ripe tomatoes.
Oh, say, how about me? Mary won't even think about food today. The girl's in love.
Isn't it grand? Just think, Mary and Harry engaged. I've known them ever since they were babies. Mary's a mighty fine girl.
Sure, and Harry's a fine young man. But, oh, Julia, Mary's so young. She's only 15 and... And to think of marrying, why...
Well, Mary's older in her ways, and most girls are 15. I'm glad she's marrying a good boy like Harry did.
Where are my hard-boiled eggs?
Now you know you shouldn't eat them. You can make out with chicken and ham and chocolate cake.
Oh, shucks, you can't have a picnic without hard-boiled eggs. You know how I like them. Oh, no, Julia, you know I like them.
Darling, as usual. Can I help you, Julia?
No, thanks, Mary. Maybe you can at the picnic.
All right.
Sit down a minute, won't you all?
Yeah. Sit down and rest your wraps a minute. I'll shake you up a cocktail. How about it, Harry?
Well, whatever the others say goes for me.
Mix us up one. Sure. Why, the 4th of July only comes once a year. What do you say, Alan?
Dinner, Ron. We all live one. Shake it up, Joe. The victim, Mary. The bride-to-be. And to Harry.
Yeah. Put one thing in the ceremony, Harry. Hard-boiled eggs on picnics or no wedding.
That's right.
Thank you, Joe. I'll sure see to that.
Well, here we are, boys. Now, drink up. Here's to a footy bride.
I'm so glad she's mine.
Is that motorcycle riding fool brother of yours, Harry?
Best brother in the state of Arkansas.
Oh, I got the drink ready. Come on, Dusty, just in time.
Hey, let's be on the spot, Dusty.
Yeah.
Hello, everybody. Thank you.
Drink
to
the bride, Dusty.
You bet. Here's to my brother's girl, the sweetest girl in the state of Arkansas.
Oh, thank you, Dusty. I'm happy today.
Fine. Come on, folks. Let's drink up quick and get on the road.
All right, folks, we all ready?
Yeah.
Let's get in the car. Joe, you take the basket.
Yeah.
Mary, you bring the glasses.
Yeah.
And Alice, you look after the basket.
Yeah, wait a minute. Anybody want to ride in the back of my motorcycle?
Ah, not today, Dusty. You got the wrong girl.
All right. Well, just for that, you'll have to eat my dust right up to Big Clear Creek.
Boy, hey, Julia, what about my hard-boiled eggs? Julia, them hard-boiled eggs of mine.
Thank you.
Oh, Mary, it's wonderful to have you out here in the country, all alone.
Oh, the world seems to have stopped today, Harry. No time, no anything. Just you and me.
And the flowers looking their prettiest. And all for you, Mary. Oh, you're lovely.
Oh, Harry. Look at the water. Doesn't it look cool?
Uh-huh.
Oh, gee, it's so warm now. I wish I were in it. What's the 4th of July without a swim?
Oh, you're such a kid, Mary.
I wish I had my bathing suit. I'd duck right in that water.
Mary, you're so impulsive. Sometimes I get scared.
Oh, scared of what?
Scared something will happen before we get married. Oh, Mary, kiss me. Hold me. Then I'll be sure you're really here.
There. Does that convince you?
Oh, it sure does, Annie.
Harry!
Oh, that's me, Barry.
Harry!
Yes, Mrs. Barrett?
Will you and Mary take this bucket and get some water?
Sure will.
We're glad to. My, hasn't it turned hot?
Yeah, Mary was talking about a swim.
Don't be too long. Joe's yelling for his victuals already. I brought him some eggs, and I'll be boiling them as soon as I get that water. Else he'll never stop talking.
Wait, Harry. Wait, Mary. Wait for me.
I'll wait, Alice. I'll wait here for Alice, Harry. You get the water for Julie yourself.
All right. See you later, honey.
All right.
Well, thanks for waiting, Mary. Oh, isn't it hot? Well, I wish we could go in bathing.
Well, why can't we?
Well, we didn't bring any suits.
Oh, what does that matter? We'll go in our step-ins.
Oh, I don't know. Somebody might see us.
Oh, there's nobody around here. And really, lots of bathing suits are just like step-ins. Come on, Alice, let's go.
Well, there goes my dress. Well, and here goes my right slipper. Mary, if I had a figure like yours, I'd be in Hollywood right now.
Oh, Big Clear Creek in Crawford County, Arkansas is good enough for me. Well, here I go into water.
Oh, gee, come on in, Alice. It's marvelous.
Well, is it very deep?
Oh, no, it's not so deep, but it's cool and
fresh. Oh, it's awful cold.
Come on in, Alice.
Oh, I am.
All right, come on.
As soon as I get this dress on.
There you are.
Here I come.
Wonderful.
Okay. I'm going to swim up the creek. Come along.
Not me. I'm not that good a fish.
Well, you mind if I swim up around the bend?
No. I'll thank you.
All right, Alice. See you later.
This chicken, especially for you.
Julia, I'm just waiting till Mary gets back. I wonder why she and Alice are so long.
Just imagine a man not able to eat because this gal, ain't he? Pass a ham, please. Wait till you've been married as long as Julia and me, Harry. You won't lose your appetite easy. Ham, please.
Here's the ham.
Thanks, Dusty.
I suppose I am foolish. This chicken is good, Julia.
Oh, you don't.
Boy, is it. And you'd better hurry up on your share, Harry. Dusty won't leave anything. He's pitching it in just like it was hay.
Sure, Roy. My brother's lost his appetite, but nothing's the matter with mine.
Oh, my. I wish we'd waited for Mary and Alice. Seems kind of unsociable, like, to start dinner without them.
Unsociable, my eye. We waited half hour. That's one thing I like about a picnic. All the house rules don't hold.
I wonder where Mary and Alice are. I think I'd better go hunt them.
Oh, they're all right, Harry. There's a dozen pairs from the creek down here. You might miss them. Don't be so nervous.
All right, Dusty, but...
Why, there's Alice now. Alice! Tell Mary to hurry.
Mary? Why isn't Mary here?
No, Alice. Where'd you leave Mary?
Well, she must be here. She left me long ago. Said she was coming right back. Oh!
Where'd you leave her?
She... I didn't leave her. She left me. We were swimming.
What? Swimming?
Yes, it was so hot, we went in our stepping.
Land safe.
While we were in, Mary started swimming up the creek. I waited a while, got dressed, and walked through the woods. I thought...
Where are you going, Harry?
I'm going to hunt Mary. Something may have happened to her.
Well, Harry, wait a minute. I'll go with you. We'll find her.
Oh, we'll find her, Harry. No, don't worry about her.
I'm going with you too, Harry.
Yeah, me too.
I'm coming along, Joe.
Oh, Mary,
I know something happened
Duster. I'm sure Mary's drowned. I'm sure of it.
No, no, Harry. Now, don't take on so. We'll find her. She's all right.
No, no, I'm sure she's drowned. You and I searched both sides of the creek. Joe and Roy have beaten the woods.
Now, look, suppose she fell asleep. Oh, she's playing a joke on us. Why, Mary is full of jokes.
Harry?
Yes, Roy? What is it? I'm coming. What is it, Roy?
Look. Look by that rock.
Mary's clothes. It's a dress. Poor kid, she's drowned.
And here's her slippers and a slip.
Oh, she's been drowned. I know she has. Call the police. Call the police. Oh, Mary,
I'll go call the sheriff's office, Dusty. You stay here and do what you can for her.
Sure, I will, Roy. No, Harry, we'll find her. She'll be all right.
Oh, I knew it. Something told me.
Ah, you know Mary. Always up to something. We'll find her. We'll find her, sure. Let's look along the creek here.
Oh, Mary.
Mom, it's pretty here. Look at that creek and the big rocks in it, Mom.
Yes, Otto. The water is lovely. This is called Big Clear Creek. The water comes way down from the Ozarks.
The Ozarks?
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I thought I would only read about them in books. Mom, I'm sure glad we could leave New York and have our vacation here.
Vacation, Otto. It was good of your father to send us here. All this distance to Arkansas for a visit.
Look, Mom. Look at that rock around the bend.
Which rock? Oh, I see now. The one where the girl is taking a sunbath.
Well, she can't be taking a sunbath, Mom. Her head's in the water.
Why, son, so it is. That is strange.
Her feet are in the water on the other side, too.
Yes, and her arm flung up that way.
Oh, Mom, she ain't got hardly any clothes on.
But she has on her underwear. Let's walk out in the creek on these rocks.
Gee, Mom, what's the matter? You look pale.
Oh, Arthur, she's dead.
Mom.
She's dead.
Mom, I don't want to see her anymore.
Arthur, don't look. Don't look, son. Oh, the poor girl.
Help! Help! Help!
What is it?
What's the matter there? Come, quick. The girl's dead. She's dead.
Mary. Oh, Mary. Oh, my darling. What have they done to you? Oh, Mary.
Look, her head. Oh, someone has beaten her.
Oh, after 2 days, Mary. We find this. I'm sorry, Harry. Here, wrap this raincoat around her. I'll help you carry her ashore.
No. I'll carry her. Alone. Give me the raincoat. I'll take in my arms. I'll carry her. Oh, Mary.
Oh, Mary.
Mary, my darling. My poor Mary. Why did they do this to you? Why?
Sheriff? The coroner's jury isn't satisfied that Mary Mehal was drowned.
Oh, neither am I, O'Neill. Accidental death when the girl's body was found on a rock 6 inches out of water.
There isn't enough current in Big Clear Creek at that spot to fling a body up on a rock that high, Sheriff.
That's my idea, O'Neill. How far down the creek did they find her?
400 yards downstream from where she was last seen bathing. The current isn't that strong.
Oh, you bet it's not. She was carried there.
What does the coroner say?
Well, he says the poor girl's neck was broken at the third vertebrae.
She could have been diving.
Nah. It was from a terrific blow with a club or a rock. It crushed her spine. That girl was dead when she was put on the rocks.
Was there any water in her lungs?
None. O'Neill, you're going to earn your money as deputy now. This is murder.
Sheriff, I'm ready. I saw the body.
Yes, just... you saw the body. The girl was only 15. Beautiful. Happy. A bride to be.
I know. That's what makes it more horrible. Just a child and yet a woman.
O'Neill, I want you to get together all the people who are on that picnic.
All right, Sheriff. You don't suspect any one of them, do you? They were all Mary Mehal's friends.
Friend or no friend, one of them could have murdered Mary Mehal.
get this over with as soon as possible.
Oh, yeah. Is everybody present, O'Neill?
Yes, Sheriff. Here are your picnickers. All of them.
Now, folks, you know what we're here for, I reckon. A girl was murdered, one of your party. Now I'm going to find out how it happened and who did it.
I'm sure we're all anxious to help you, Sheriff, but I think you're barking up the wrong tree. We were all together when this thing happened.
You all were the last to see Mary Mayhaw alive. That's why you're here. Now, have any of you anything to tell me, or must I do the talking?
Oh, no, sure.
How can we share?
I don't know.
So that's it, eh? All right, then I'll do some questioning. Which of you saw her alive last?
I did. I guess I was in swimming with her.
Tell us the whole story.
Well, it was warm, so Mary and I went in. Mary swam around the bend, and after a while, I dressed and came back. That's all I know, I guess.
The last time you saw Mary, then, was when she swam around the bend.
Yes, that's the last time.
What did you do then?
Well, I went back to the crowd. They were eating.
And?
And then they asked me where Mary was. I told them what I told you.
Yes, yes, I know. Miss Gray, Mr. Guilford here is your friend, isn't he?
Roy? Sure, he's my friend. I've known him for years.
Then why didn't you go in swimming with him?
With Roy? Why, I just never thought of it. That's why, I guess.
Oh, that ain't the reason. You had a date with someone, didn't you? You met someone at that creek now, didn't you?
I did not. I most certainly
did. Stop lying, Miss Gray. Who'd you meet when you went in swimming?
Nobody, I tell you. I was there with Mary, nobody else.
And you didn't see anybody else there either?
No, nobody.
Where were you, Guilford?
Well, what do you mean?
You know what I mean. Where were you when the girls went swimming?
Well, I was with the others.
Oh, no, not all the time you weren't. Where did you go? Talk, Guilford. Come on, tell the truth.
Well, I didn't go anyplace.
Yes, you did. You were away for a half hour before Miss Gray returned. Now, where'd you go?
Oh, yes, I remember. Yeah, I went for some wood. That's right. We were going to build a fire, and we needed some twigs.
And it took you half an hour to find a few twigs. You expect us to believe that?
Well, I don't care if you believe it or not. It's the truth.
You liked Miss Mayhaw, didn't you, Guilford?
Oh, no more than I did many other girls.
Well, you liked her more than you did Miss Gray, didn't you?
Well, how did... Well, that makes no... Well, no, I didn't. Mary was Harry's girl.
That didn't make any difference to you now, did it?
What do you mean, Sheriff?
Ask your friend here what I mean. He'll tell you.
Oh, don't believe him, Harry. He's only trying to make trouble.
We're only trying to find out who killed Mary Mayhaw. Now tell us what you know, Guilford, or we'll tell you a few things, and you may not like that so much.
All I have to say is that I didn't kill Mary, and I don't know who did. About that other thing, I did go out with Mary once or twice. I don't see what that has to do with solving this case.
You went out with Mary? Why didn't you tell me, Roy?
Oh, it was nothing, Alice.
I'll fix you for that, Roy. You'll be sorry you messed around with my girl.
How about you, Mr. Barrett? What were you doing while the girls were in swimming?
I can answer that, Sheriff. My husband here was interfering with everyone on account of those hard-boiled eggs.
Who are they?
Oh, you don't understand. Real eggs, I mean. Oh. Joe's crazy about them, and he wants us to make some for him, right in the middle of setting the table.
I see, I see. Did you leave the party at all, Barrett?
No, but I should have. Those girls down for the July picnics give me a pain.
Oh, you gave Mary Mayhaw a drink intoxicating liquor before you went on this picnic, didn't you?
What in the world are you driving at? You don't think I had anything to do with this, do you?
It so happens that I'm the sheriff here, Barrett, and I'm asking the questions, not you.
All right, Sheriff. Yes, Mary Mayhaw had a drink before she left, but so did we all. What about it?
I say, we ain't getting anywhere, folks. Come here, Jordan.
Which one, Sheriff? Me or my brother?
You. You're the one who was engaged to Mary, aren't you?
Yes.
When was the last time you saw her?
When she went in swimming.
Did you see her go into the water?
No. She said she'd like to go in alone. But Mrs. Baird called me to do something. Later I found out she went in with Alice.
You found out?
Yes, from Alice. She came back, and when we asked where Mary was, she said she thought Mary had come back.
Then you were the last one to see Mary Mayhaw alive, Miss Gray.
I guess so. Outside of the one who killed her.
Mrs. Barrett, who was missing besides these two girls?
Well, I can't say for sure, but near as I can remember, Harry Jordan here was the only other one. He went for some water. I sent him.
All the others were there with you?
I think so, but I can't be sure, Sheriff. Joe here was making such a fuss about...
Well, what about Guilford?
He was there. Yes, later he left for a little while to get some twigs, he said.
Yeah. He said. Jordan.
And me, Sheriff?
No, not this time. Your brother now, Dusty.
Yes, sir, Sheriff. What is it?
Were you away from the party at any time while these girls were swimming?
Not that I remember.
Well, Dusty.
Yes, you were. Well, come to think of it, I was for a little while. I went for some water.
Oh, so you went for some water, too.
Yes. Mr. Barrett here wanted some hard-boiled eggs, so I figured I'd surprise him and get some water and...
But Miss Barrett sent me for the water.
Yes, I know. That was after I'd gone.
Now, just a minute. And you went before your brother did?
I don't know. That is, I might have. I really don't remember.
You went for water. What'd you expect to carry it in? I had the only bucket.
Well, you remember, Harry. I had a canvas bucket in my motorcycle kit. I was going to get the...
I remember now.
Remember what? What's the matter, Miss Gray?
I just recalled something. Something that might be important.
Oh, yeah? Well, come on. What is it?
Well, you remember asking me if I saw anybody when Mary and I went in swimming?
Yes, I remember. Now, did you?
No, I didn't see anybody.
Well, I'll be... Say, what's the idea? You playing with us or something?
No, but I heard something. Something that I just thought of.
Oh, you did. Well, come on. Tell us. What was it?
Well, when Mary swam around the bend, I heard a motorcycle coming down the road. It stopped, and then I heard a voice, a man's voice, say, "Must be fun in there." And then he said something else, but I couldn't understand what it was. Dusty rides a motorcycle, but I don't know where...
Oh, just a minute. Come on, get out of my way.
Hold
the boy. Stop. 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 Shoot you, Jordan. Oh, I'm trying to get away. You can't make
it. You did it, Dusty. You, my own brother. You killed my girl.
Oh, Harry.
I'm a kid over there.
Harry, wait a minute. I didn't mean it. I didn't mean to kill her. It was an accident. I didn't mean it.
Come on, Jordan. Talk, and talk straight.
Well, I knew the girls were going for a swim. I heard them talking about it. And so I took my motorcycle and I rode up to the bend in the creek.
Oh, my, this is fun. It's so cool. Gee, I just don't know what to listen.
Must be fun in there, Miss Barry. Want a cigarette?
Sure. Throw me one.
Oh, all right. Here. Catch it.
Okay. I got it.
You got it?
Yeah. What good is a cigarette without a match?
Well, come and get one. I dare you.
I will not. Don't be silly. I'm going to stay right here behind this bush.
Oh, come on. I dare you. What are you afraid of?
Well, all right. You don't mind, I don't.
Well, come on. Here it is. Mary, give us a little kiss, huh?
Oh, no, we'll not. Don't. Please don't, Dusty. Oh, I wish I hadn't come out here.
Oh, come on, give me a little kiss, Mary.
Oh, no, please.
Oh, come on, now don't be stinky, Mary.
Please
just
let me
a little,
don't.
Oh,
please
come on.
Don't.
Come on, give me.
Please, Dusty, stop the news. I'll just hurt my head. I'll call Harry and let go of me. Stop it. You're joking. Oh, no.
Clyde Jordan, you have heard the verdict of the jury. Guilty of manslaughter in the first degree. Manslaughter of the girl your own brother intended to marry. I hereby sentence you to 7 years in state prison.
Strange Adventure.
Sam Dalton sat in the stern sheets of his outrigger canoe and gazed out across the rippled blue waters of the lagoon. The little palm-studded island made a perfect hideout for the pearl poacher. It lay far off the steamer tracks and trading schooners called here only twice a year. Moreover, it was a tropical paradise. The natives were friendly, the women beautiful, and a great bed of pearl oysters lay here. The white man had the whole lagoon to himself, for it was a feast day on the island. Now was his chance to get away from the ever-watchful eyes of the giant pearl diver, Mahili. He smiled as he anchored his canoe over the bed of pearl oysters. It had taken him long months of practice to be able to work the bottom at a depth of 40 feet. Mahili had been friendly enough, though he had shown some suspicion of the white stranger who arrived on the last trading schooner. Both men knew of the vast wealth that lay upon the bottom of the lagoon. Both men wanted it. But one thing Mahili didn't know, that the stranger could now dive well enough to explore the pearl beds for himself. All he had to do was to lower himself over the side and load his basket with shells. He could beach his canoe some distance from the village and open the shells at his leisure. When the next schooner stopped by, he would have enough pearls to pay his fare to New Zealand or some other place where he was not wanted by the police. He slipped off his canvas shoes, towed the line above the weighted basket, and lowered himself over the side. Like a plummet, he sank through the clear, sunlit water. He reached a coral ledge and halted. From here, he could look out over the floor of the lagoon. Before him, he could see a mass of large pearl oysters. He released the line and caught at a craggy outcropping of the coral ledge. He knew that he must hurry, for already he was beginning to feel the effect of the sea pressure and the lack of fresh air. He grasped an outgrowth of coral with one hand and pulled himself downward until he could just reach the nearest shell. He gave the shell a quick wrench, but it was too firmly fastened to the coral. He kicked his legs and propelled himself nearer to the patch of oysters. A sudden current swayed his body. He felt himself drawn underneath the ledge. The next instant, his right leg was caught in a vice-like grip. Then he saw what held him. A horrified glance revealed the coral-encrusted shell of a giant clam, the deadly pahua of the South Seas. He became mad with fear. His lungs almost burst for want of air. His grip on the coral was gradually weakening, and his leg was almost numb with pain. Suddenly, he felt a rush of water at his side. A large body was moving toward him. He closed his eyes and waited for the death that would soon come. Sam Dalton awoke to the gentle rocking of a canoe being rowed across the lagoon and heard Mahivi, the native he had tried to outwit, say almost patronizingly,
"You hurt very bad. Soon you be all right. Police patrol boat come by today. I take you there now. Good doctor aboard make you well."
This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye from my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of
Strange Adventure.
Okay, that's it. This is another Night Transmissions in the can. Oh, by the way, you should go to the website, nighttransmissions.com. Night Transmissions, just one word. And on that page you'll find information about everything that was on the show. Oh, and I don't mention this often enough. There's a phone number, a G-Voice phone number. The odds of you getting through to me or any human being are rather remote, but it is a good place to leave messages, and I like it when that happens. The Google Voice number is 541-995-0594. Give us a call. In any case, just a thought. See ya.